Good morning, everyone. Do we have me up? You can hear me? Okay, great. I don't think when the minister was going through the number of esteemed jurists in the room, I have to admit I was a little taken aback. So good morning to all of you. It's lovely to have this opportunity to actually talk to all of you. Now, I'm here in my professional capacity as a futurist, and that is still a poorly understood term. And so when most people hear the word futurist, this is what they think. That's a psychic. They will tell you who's going to win the Melbourne Cup. They will tell you the winning lotto numbers. This is not what I do. A futurist is a little bit more like a climatologist. What we do is we can't tell you whether it's going to rain tomorrow, but we can tell you whether it's going to be rainier in 5 or 10 years. Because what we're doing is we're looking at the prevailing trends, and our job is to take those prevailing trends and to translate them into terms that other folks can then use to make decisions about what they want to do in the future. So see this entire talk in this light rather than you're going to find out who's going to win the Melbourne Cup. Okay. Now, I have a brand new podcast called The Next Billion Seconds, which you should all listen to. It's a really good podcast. We talk to people who are creating the future. How long is a billion seconds, you might say? Well, a billion seconds from today is the last day of January in 2050, which turns out to be very appropriate since we're taking a look at 2050. So a billion seconds, a generation, 31 years, 256 days, into the future brings us to January 2050. All right. Now, I personally still plan to be here. If I can, God willing, I will still be here. I will probably look something like that. That is my uncle. He's turning 80 next month. We will come back to him. But let's just turn it the other way. Let's take a look at someone who's going to be my age now. I'm 55 now. Someone who's going to be 55 in 2050 is going to be 24-ish today. They're going to be 55, 56. Let's take a look at the Australia that they're living in. So if the current population trends hold, Australia will have a population of around 38 million. That's the current prediction. And I know that sounds like a lot from our point of view of 24 million today. 38 million is still less than California has as a population right now, 39 million. And I know we hear a lot of noise coming from the little Australia crowd. They worry about housing and battery hen living and all of that. California is a lot smaller than Australia. And by the way, California has a lot of desert in it. If you haven't been to California, there's a lot of desert in California. Maybe proportionately less than Australia, but there's still quite a bit of it. And it still manages 39 million without too much of a problem. It somehow has managed to do that. So there is no reason to believe that Australia is somehow going to fail this challenge of demography. We are going to have 38 million people and everyone's going to go, what were we so worried about? The climate. The climate is, of course, warmer. It's, of course, drier, except when it's colder and wetter. Because unpredictability becomes one of the key features in the climate going forward. And a lot of our time is spent in planning to avoid obvious mistakes in planning, such as situating an entire city on a floodplain. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to talk about Brisbane, but we all remember 2011. That process of projecting is never perfect. And so the insurance industry has become a very interesting, different beast because it's constantly rejecting claims on climate grounds because climate riders became features of every insurance policy that was written basically past the 2020s. Now, Australia and New Zealand in particular have become the refugee landing point for a generation of Pacific Islanders who found their homes disappearing as sea levels rose a half a meter, which is roughly what's expected somewhere between 2050 and 2060, and keep rising. So these folks are going to be coming and living in Australia, and they're going to be giving our culture a distinct islander flavor that it doesn't have yet. Those numbers are going to be next to nothing, next to the 100 million Bangladeshis who are going to be displaced. when the sea levels rise and their entire Delta nation actually goes away, and they're going to be finding homes in Myanmar and India and any place that will have them. But that's 100 million climate refugees right there that we know is already baked into the climate. The summers are still too hot. The winters are still too short. No one's burning coal, at least not here in Australia. Most of the vehicles are electric. The few that aren't probably are using diesel and not petrol. Petrol is rare. And the petrol stations themselves became really, really valuable commercial real estate in the 2030s as they stopped being used. Now, although there was this prediction in the late teens that all of the vehicles would be autonomous and driverless from the early 2020s, it didn't work out that way. Now, here's the thing. Pop back a second. I woke up this morning and something had happened overnight and I had to put it on a slide. And this is what happened. So if you don't know, last month in Arizona, a self-driving car hit and killed a woman. And the National Transportation Safety Board conducted an analysis, and the results of that analysis were released this morning, Australia time. And it turned out that the feature of the car that would cause the car to do an emergency brake if it saw something in its path had been turned off. So the car didn't stop when it saw the passenger because the software inside of that car had been told not to. And now you have just seen an entirely new legal vista open up, which is the intersection between technology and law and liability. This is just this morning this happened. Now, you've all been told that all of the cars are going to be driving themselves within 2 or 3 years. Not going to happen. This week, Brisbane hosted the International Robotics Conference. It just ended yesterday. I have a bunch of friends who were up here for it. When you talk to people who have spent their years doing robotics, they say that is a pipe dream, that driving a self-driving car is much harder than anyone in the car industry understands. That's why they tell you it's coming. But if you ask someone who's been building robots for 30 years, they're going to go, nah. Let me show you an example of why this is hard. You think of folding a towel. It's something we do all the time. It is not particularly hard. This is what it's like when a robot tries to fold a towel. It takes a robot 10 minutes because it's spending the first 6 minutes just trying to find the corners of the cloth. Humans are really good at dealing with weird things we've never encountered before, with exceptions, because evolution has equipped us with the fact that the world is weird and always coming at us in different ways. We can roll with the punches. Our machines, not so much. And the more that we're working with our machines to make them autonomous, the more that we're starting to understand where the limits are, at least with our current capabilities. It's super easy to overload a machine with data. It's very hard to teach it to discriminate on what data is important and what data it can be safely ignored. And for this reason, by 2050, we're going to have lots of drones because it's going to be much easier to navigate in the sky. There's a whole lot less going on the sky than there is going on a city street. I was driving in a taxi down George Street. If any of you are from Sydney, you know what I'm talking about right now. And the taxi driver and I were trying to figure out in real time how to get to Town Hall because we couldn't remember which parts of George Street were closed right now because it changes from day to day. And you can't imagine giving that to a self-driving car, trying to read around all of these instructions and weird signs. And a self-driving car would literally have a nervous breakdown. We were having enough trouble. So you're going to have autonomous drones, and cities are going to have this weird background buzzing sound like there's a beehive somewhere, because there's going to be a lot of drones going lots of places. It also is going to mean that occasionally packages will just drop out of the skies, which is going to be another thriving area of the insurance industry in 2050. So the roads as we know them, they're only slowly being colonized by autonomous vehicles. The first place we're going to see it, and we will see this within a decade, is interstate trucking. So trucking between cities on the highway, that's easy to automate. There's not a lot of decision involved in driving a truck down a highway. Within a decade, most of that will be happening. But once you actually get to the border of a city, human beings are going to get into the cockpit. Probably public bus routes will also be automated relatively quickly. We don't know, but we think that's going to be the case. Possibly delivery vans, possibly. And then things are going to stall, and mostly that's going to be for insurance reasons, because you simply won't be able to buy insurance on an autonomous vehicle because it's going to be considered to be too much of a liability. So people do drive. But interestingly, public transport's also become a lot more accessible, because what we're seeing is that you'll be able to open up whatever device you have. It might look like a smartphone, it might not, and say, this is where I want to go. And then the app's going to figure out how it's going to do it, and it's all just going to feel seamless to you. And either a car will pull up, or it'll say, walk down to the end of the street, and the bus will pull up, and you'll go to your destination. And when you have that level of ease and integration in it, it makes the decision about whether to drive or whether to take public transport much more flexible. Ride sharing will probably still be popular. So let's talk a little bit about the world of work in 2050. So that's Rich. Rich is another futurist, and this is a talk that he gave at the G20 that I was at in 2015. And you can see the chart here on the left. That's the chart for how a career works, probably for almost everyone in this room. There's a series of graduated steps. You graduate from uni, you get your first big job, you start moving your way up the system, you get to the top and you retire. And that's the way it was for most of the 20th century. And then that chart on the right, that's what we would call the millennial career path. We blame it on their innate ability to be distracted, that they're always kind of looking for the next thing, that they can't stick around, that they don't have stick-to-itiveness. We try to sort of blame them for the fact that their career paths kind of look like chutes and ladders. Maybe it's too much screen time, we think. Maybe it's all of that Instagram. Well, actually what's happening is that's reflecting a deeper structure in the changing nature of work. And all they're doing is adapting to the fact that in order to have the best career for themselves, they need to be flexible. And those career changes and those opportunities are taken when they present themselves because they see this as the best path for themselves in the future. One of the reasons this is going to be the case is because automation, which we think is going to be putting everyone out of work, didn't really end up doing that. But what it did end up doing is it ended up making employment a moving target. Because what happens is automation removes layers of clerical functions, as witnessed right here on this sign. This is what they're promising you here. They're going to remove layers of clerical functions. So the bookkeeping and the scheduling and the annotating and the validating, all of that stuff, yeah, sure, that's all going to be done really nicely by machines. Job functions begin to migrate away from organizational roles, the infrastructure roles, into roles that help the organization maintain coherence, so the sort of meta roles. What we need and the skills that are treasured in 2050 are the kind of skills that help organizations think on their feet. In other words, organizations that can respond to a world that's moving quickly. So not only are the organizations going to need those skills, but in order for those organizations to have those skills, every employee inside those organizations will need those skills. How's that going to happen? Well, we're in the middle of a shift right now, and by 2050, professional practice will become inseparable from what we call professional development. This is a key feature of 2050. It means that everyone working, and it really doesn't matter what field you're working in, everyone working spends about as much time and energy learning the next skill they will be practicing as they do practicing the skills they've already learned. And as a result, in 2050, to make all of this work, there is an enormous emphasis on mentoring. It's basically become a mentoring-centered work culture. Everyone is mentoring everyone else. Everyone is being mentored by everyone else. That is your expectation in the workplace, that you will be attracted to the positions that offer you the best mentoring and the best opportunities to mentor. There's also going to be an enormous emphasis on machine-guided skills acquisition. And we'll come to what that means a little bit later on. But this is not an either-or future. First thing you have to know as a futurist is the future is not about either-ors. It's always about both ands. And so the barrier between what constitutes education and what constitutes practice, that collapsed. And it collapsed long before 2050, and it's not coming back. And it didn't collapse for any one reason. It didn't collapse because of any one decision. It collapsed because the whole world changed. And the whole world changed long before 2018. I want to show you one face of how that changed. Wikipedia. We never realized until we saw it in practice that people have expertise. And when we have expertise, we feel compelled to share that expertise. And that was true long before Wikipedia made it easy, because actually that's part of what makes us human. It turns out that each of us have a passionate desire to share, and each of us have a passionate desire to mentor. It's a human quality. It's been part of us from year dot. And so what's happened is that the apprenticeship system is, in 2050, going great guns. And this is really important for another reason. As you saw from the folding towel, robots are not particularly agile. Robots make lousy plumbers and lousy electricians. And although you can get a robot to pour the foundation of your house in 2050, heaven help you if you set them to the interior work. It really is just too fiddly and too complicated, and they will just make bumbling mistakes, which they won't be smart enough to know they did. And so you have all of these highly skilled trades. That could be plumbing, it could be building, it could be medicine, it could be the law, that still demand years of mentoring before you're really considered fit to practice. Now, that is not to say that there are not robotic surgeons. There are right now. They sew patients up much better than human doctors do. It's not to say that there aren't incredibly potent AI-powered paralegals who can search 200 years of case law in a few minutes to find every precedent that might be relevant. They already have that. And it doesn't mean that the electrician or the plumber are working in the same way in 2050 as they are in 2018. Because, to be sure, they are using some amazing tools that help them always make the best possible decisions. But at the end, it's still them making those decisions, even in 2050. So the economy has a productive base of individuals using these machines to be as productive as they can. But how intensely we focus on productivity as an end to itself is one of the larger shifts we're seeing in 2050. Come back to this. This is, you know, the snakes and ladders career path of the millennial. It models a focus on any particular goal in search of just sort of the most interesting next opportunity. That constant movement from opportunity to opportunity, that's not actually opportunistic. It's an exploration. It's a journey in a world of possibilities into understanding the capacities and the places that one might fit at any point in one's journey. And they're doing this in 2050, when they have great tools to help them do their best flexibly, both today and for the world they want to be in tomorrow. Now, flexibility has a cost, because to be a jack of all trades is to be a master of none. But people trust that when they need to, they can buckle down, they can find the resources they need, both human and machine tools, to achieve some level of mastery in something. And so by 2050, that's become the main goal of our educational system. We're migrating away from the rote acquisition of facts toward capacity building. We are preparing children for lifelong learning, for lifelong mentoring, for lifelong growth in capacities. It's not just, okay, you're 21 years old and now you're done. See you later. This means that teaching is actually a much more human task in 2050 than it was, say, 100 years before that. It means that the classroom finally looks a lot more like the rest of the world. Students spend about half their time peer-mentoring other students in the subjects that they've already mastered, and they spend the other half being peer-mentored by other students in the subjects that they've yet to master. And all of that sounds simple enough, but none of it actually works without the presence of a teacher who is there keeping a careful eye on all of it, stepping in as needed to adjudicate, to remediate, and to encourage, as a good mentor should. Assessments have gone out the window. NAPLAN is just a weird, bad memory. Now you laugh. I gave a talk to a room full of educators in the Hunter 2 weeks ago when I said NAPLAN, there wasn't quiet laughter, there was loud laughter, because we're clear this is just not the right thing to do. So in 2050, you are judged by what your peers can assess you as being capable of, because your peers are your avenue to work in 2050. Almost all work in 2050 is project-based. Almost all project teams are temporary. They're brought together for a purpose, and once that purpose is achieved, the team is disbanded again. Back in 2018, we had an organizational name for it. It was called Holacracy, and it looks like chaos to someone who has a very firm belief in that sort of hierarchical corporate org chart, that they should have a top and a bottom and a clearly defined role for every position in the org chart. But the organizations who clung to that, they failed to adapt. They simply couldn't change their internal structure fast enough as the entire world changed around them, and so they found themselves unable to compete against these freewheeling temporary agglomerations of human capacity and talent organized around specific goals. Because that's kind of what the work world, the business world, looks like in 2050. Now, people still earn money, of course. People still compete for a good spot on the best teams doing the most interesting projects. And you get those coveted spots by having the best profile and the best connections. So a lot of what people are doing in 2050, all the time, is they're sharing what they're doing with others. This is what selfie culture looks like in 2050. It's not, look at my great holiday, or look at my great boyfriend, or whatever, look at my beautiful life. It's, look at my incredible scale, look at my incredible project, look at my incredible team. It's that, because this is the way that you let your networks know that you have the capacity that they want to bring you into their networks to work for them. And yes, that sounds like it's more work than just sitting at a desk and bashing through a set of KPIs. But in the world of 2050, everything is in motion, both the nature of work itself and the work. So this continuous upskilling that everyone is involved in, and this continuous sharing of their skills that everyone is involved in, is simply the way it works from grade one. Never changes. It's always the same. It's always about sharing, mentoring, learning, upskilling, and being involved in teams that help you to share and mentor and learn and upskill. So it's like that from grade one until the day folks retire. Now, about that, to come back to this. As I said, I am going to be 87 in 2050. I hope that I'm still working. And I'm using as a model, that's my uncle Amadeo. He's turning 80 at the end of next month. Now, he's quite a famous researcher. And they forced him to retire from his position at university when he turned 70. He was at the University of Cincinnati for about 30 years. They asked him to retire, forced him to retire. He didn't want to. He's like, well, what am I going to do with myself? And then he started working at a series of startups. And at the last startup he was working at, he was managing 1,500 people. So he's done very well for himself. He's slowing down a little bit. He told me that one time when his boss was giving him a raise, he was also criticizing him for occasionally falling asleep in meetings. But he loves to work, and he plans on working as long as he can. And that's my own personal goal, because it means that I'm continuing to find my own work exciting and rewarding in 2050. People retire today because they're tired, because they're bored, because they're ready to move on, or because the organization is ready to move on. It's not because they're done, and yet that's often our attitude. Now, in 2050, people don't have to work as they grow older. Superannuation remains one of the wisest decisions ever implemented by an Australian government. But it's really clear by 2050 that there is a strong correlation between work and quality of life and longevity. So most people keep their hand in, mentoring and learning and doing what they can for as long as they can. And I can tell you that's absolutely where I see myself in a billion seconds. In that billion seconds, for me to continue at 87, I'm going to need some help. And fortunately, there are going to be some systems that can help me. Now, this is a really good moment to start to dispel a few myths about what we can and cannot expect out of artificial intelligence in 2050. Artificial intelligence is an incredibly powerful tool, but it's like a hammer. It's a very specific tool. It is said that when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that's roughly where our thinking is with artificial intelligence today. Everything looks like a problem that we can solve if only we apply artificial intelligence. And that is less true than we might think today. And the growing consensus of people who are deeply involved in the field, people who have spent their entire careers working in artificial intelligence and robotics, is that actually there are real limits to both, and we're starting to see some of those limits. And so, just as with autonomous vehicles, we will see slow progress in artificial intelligence. It's going to be true for everything it gets applied to in the real world. But that said, the simple and straightforward tasks, the automation tasks, yeah, those have probably gone away. We're not worrying about those very much anymore. And the nice side of that is there's a lot of automation that's actually really quite useful to us. So, for example, when I meet people, even today, I do a fair number of talks. I meet a fair number of people. I struggle to remember people's names. I struggle to remember how I met these people. And within a few years, we're going to have a little whispering voice in our ears that's going to be feeding us those details. They're going to be prompting us out of our forgetfulness. It's going to be a sophisticated bit of facial recognition and personal history and something that's out there scouring the net for facts about that person as they walk up to you and stick their hand out. And that will be very important when I'm 87, I'm sure of that, though we're going to have this within the next few years. But what that points at is that the way we regard memory is starting to change. In 2018, you can already see people using Google and Wikipedia as almost a sort of external memory. When we can't remember something, we turn ourselves to the machines because the machines do remember. And that's only going to become more and more and more of a feature, both as the population ages and as there becomes more detail to remember in the world. And both of those are going to be accelerating in the years to 2050. Well more than a quarter of all Australians will be over 65 by 2050. And we'll all be living in a world that is so dense with information, we are going to need these very smart support tools in order to find our way through. Now, we're always going to face the dilemma of what we want to offload to the machines. We already do face that dilemma. I want you to consider something. No one does long division anymore. They still teach it. What grade? Is it second, third, fourth grade? Do they teach long division? Is it fourth, year four? Something like that, right? We don't know because it's lost in our past, but we all remember it. No one likes doing it. Long division is just horrible. We learn to do it, and then forever after, and of course, I learned long division before there were calculators everywhere. So you just learn long division. But now, of course, everyone just uses a calculator because there are calculators pretty much put into everything we have. And so whenever we have to do long division, we use a calculator. And it's better and it's faster. And you can make an argument, and some have, that there's been an atrophy in our mental skills, or at least in that corner of our math skills. Other people might argue that that's mental energy that would be better spent on more human problems. And this is an argument that's going to be very current in 2050 as we decide moment to moment which parts of our memories are best offloaded to all of the machines in the world. And for an 87-year-old, that question might read very differently than it will for, say, a 24-year-old. Or maybe not. Because that 24-year-old, now 55-year-old, growing up in this world of rich AI tools, they might be a whole lot more relaxed about which parts of their memory are outside and which parts of their memory are floating around inside of their heads. Probably some will be really relaxed about it and others will be super strict about it. But in 2050, we will have cognitive supports that help us to be vital and active and contributing for as long as possible. And that, in turn, will help us into increased longevity precisely because we're active and we're wanted. I'm constantly reminded of Prince Philip, who is not from a particularly long-lived family and who turns 97 next week. And I think the largest reason of that is because he's had something to do every day to get out of bed for the last 97 years. And all of us are going to start to be in that virtuous cycle that means there's a lot more active seniors in 2050 than we see today. But this particular rose has some interesting thorns. There is a serious side effect associated with the use of artificial intelligence. It's something that we haven't really seen until quite recently. But it's something that's become so obvious we can't ignore it anymore. So, if you went over to Google Image Search today and type in the word baby, you will see lots of images of babies, all of them cute and nearly all of them white. That's not because most babies are white babies. It's because Google's image search is an artificial intelligence system which is learning what images to deliver based on the selections that people make when those images come up. So every time someone selects an image in this system, the system learns it. And it turns out that people overwhelmingly select the images of cute white babies. And Google has watched this happen millions upon millions upon millions of times. Its teachers are millions of people, very few of whom would think of themselves as racist, but who in aggregate drove Google to deliver a racially biased result. And that's a big problem right there. That is a problem too big to ignore. And Google isn't really the problem here. Google simply made the problem visible. Artificial intelligence turns out to be incredibly good at amplifying human biases. And so as we use AI tools in more ways, more and more of our biases will be amplified. And where we're using these tools as an aid to our judgment or as an aid to our memory, we are going to find ourselves making decisions with amplified unconscious bias. Now, there is a rather notorious case, you probably know about this, from the United States, a system called COMPAS, the Correctional Offender Management Profiling for Alternative Sanctions. It was much more prone to label non-white offenders as likely recidivists, wrongly flagging them at twice the rate of whites. Can an algorithm be racist, or does it simply embody the biases of its creators? And as more and more of the world becomes algorithmic, the areas where our unconscious biases can be amplified increase dramatically. And by 2050, much of the world will be algorithmic. The rules by which it runs, almost entirely autonomously, almost entirely invisibly, those rules will have been learned from us. And right now, we're embedding all sorts of unconscious biases into that autonomous world. Systems that select for white babies and against black offenders. And so by 2050, we live in a world where these aren't just isolated examples we can point at, but where these examples are pervasive, where the algorithmic amplification of human bias becomes so prevalent that it becomes difficult to see beyond them. We can already see what that looks like today. The darker corners of Facebook, where racists congregate and amplify their own hatred. Facebook has made that problem worse because Facebook uses artificial intelligence to watch which stories that its users are responding to and then feeds them more stories like that. So Facebook tends to make racists more racist. This is the uglier side of the future. And this is the part of the next billion seconds that requires very careful attention and demands that we make changes in the present based on what we already know. We need to lean into our impartiality. We need to build tools to amplify our impartiality. And we already have human tools to aid us. We have ethical frameworks, we have practices, we have philosophies. And in the years forward to 2050, we will be needing to embed these frameworks within the designs of our algorithms, or the algorithms of bias will overwhelm any attempt we have to make an unbiased decision. This is a lovely line. First, we shape the tools, and then the tools shape us. So a lot of human labor in 2050 will consist of inspecting these algorithms, testing these algorithms for bias, and amending them. You can think of it almost as a gardening approach to artificial intelligence, because you're basically pruning the plants, you're doing some weeding. That seems like a very fit occupation for someone in their 80s, by the way. Now, even with these sorts of dangers, artificial intelligence becomes indispensable. There's a company here in Brisbane called Maxwell Plus. They are already using artificial intelligence to improve diagnostic outcomes for cancer patients. And they're working to create a fully fledged medical AI, which is basically being fed all of your data as a patient. And they want that AI to be able to advise you all the time on the best decisions you can make for your health. But there's been a lot of overpromising in this area already, and IBM just got kicked out of a major hospital in America because their Watson AI system failed to live up to the promises they were making for it. Because this is not a solved problem. This is a hard problem. This problem takes most of the years to 2050. And we aren't close to where we need to be. We have a long way to go. the changes we're going to see with artificial intelligence are incremental, but they will be continuous. We can expect all of this to get better gradually as these systems learn more and as we get better at tuning them, because there's a lot of human involvement in artificial intelligence. Same thing's going to be true for our money. I haven't really talked about economics, but we should. So by 2050, your bank is going to have disappeared into something that, at least in 2018 terms, looks a lot like an app. But it's a financial management app that's keeping your assets in circulation, earning as much as they can for as long as they can until the moment you need something liquid and it converts part of those assets on the fly to satisfy your liquid asset needs. And it's actually going to know when you're going to need that because it's been watching you all the time and it's worked out a model of, oh, wait, he's going to need to buy himself a cup of coffee this morning, so we're going to convert $5. It knows your spending and consumption patterns. Now, money is even in 2018 on the threshold of becoming smart. What that means is that people are actually binding algorithms to money. They're binding code to money. Now, some people are running around hailing this as the end of commercial law, or at least commercial lawyers. And I got to tell you this, nothing could be further from the truth. When you automate commercial law with smart money, it means that you're going to be automating your errors and then repeating them at scale. Because I can tell you, 35 years as a programmer, all programs have bugs. All contracts presumably have little bugs in them as well. And that keeps everyone rolling along. We are still going to need lawyers to argue these contracts and judges to decide the outcomes of these contracts. But I'll tell you this. When a 17-year-old comes to me and says, okay, Mark, you're a futurist. What should I be studying at uni next year? I say that their best career opportunities lie at the intersection of law and computer science, because a dual degree in those disciplines sets them up well for a career to 2050 and beyond. At that intersection between those two disciplines lies most of the economy of 2050. It's a collision of business practice and contract law and algorithmic operation. And those skills are going to be vital for everyone who's fighting for a slice of an economy that by 2050 has become a mixture of algorithmic process and human pruning of those processes. Efficiencies are always being checked by human oversight. Algorithms will constantly be seeking advantage over one another, and we're going to have humans watching that to make sure that the algorithms aren't taking illegal shortcuts. Greed is a human bias, and that bias is surely going to end up in our algorithms. What are we going to be spending that money on? We're already starting to see a transition from an era of material acquisition into an era of experiential acquisition, that we're entering the age of experience. It doesn't mean that we're not going to want to have nice things, but it means that there's going to be an emphasis. You can already see this in selfie culture as it is today. Someone doesn't really photograph an item in selfie culture. They photograph the amazing experience they're having on the beach or the yoga retreat or whatever it is, so that there's now become this capacity to value experience as a thing. And so people in many ways will be moving toward an experiential-based culture. A lot of manufacturing, not all of it, will be done by machine. And so a lot of what we think of as the material world will become less expensive. But a lot of the experiential world, because it's driven by humans and it's a human experience, will remain expensive because humans are just expensive. And so that becomes the way people flaunt their wealth, is in the age of experience. So now, come full circle, and we are back again in 2050. The world of 2050 does not see us liberated from our worst impulses. But if we're wise, it's a world where we are vigilant, and we use the new tools we've got to support that vigilance. We cannot automate our wisdom. All we can do is apply it as we see that it's needed. And that's certainly our most important role in the years to 2050. And it's a role that we can take up from today as we mentor, as we teach, as we remind those who are coming up after us that we need to take great care where our decisions touch the lives of others. And if we do that wisely, then 2050 can be a more human world. Thank you.